this is Danielle Fisher. Welcome to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia. Now that we have much more effective medical therapy for melanoma, the question that has emerged is, when should we scan our melanoma patients? Should we be more aggressive in our pursuit of identifying potential metastases, or should we exercise caution to avoid unnecessary scans, radiation exposure, and patient anxiety? In today's podcast, we're peeling back the layers of this controversial issue so that you can make informed decisions on when to scan your patient. Leading our discussion today is Associate Professor Sydney Chung. Sydney is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon and head and neck surgeon at Melanoma Institute Australia and Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Sydney. We also have Associate Professor Alexander Vanacoy in the studio. Alex is the Associate Professor of Melanoma Surgical Oncology at MIA, the University of Sydney, and Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. We're also joined by Associate Professor Alex Menzies. Alex is a medical oncologist and an Associate Professor of Melanoma Medical Oncology at MIA, the University of Sydney, and Royal North Shore and Mater Hospitals. I'd also like to welcome Dr. Edward Chow to the studio today. Edward is a radiologist and nuclear medicine specialist at Mater Imaging. And lastly, we are delighted to have Dr. Kevin London joining us today. Kevin is a nuclear medicine specialist at the Children's Hospital at Westmead and clinical senior lecturer at the University of Sydney. Welcome to you all and thank you for being here today. Let's dive right in. Knowing when to scan your melanoma patient is a somewhat controversial topic. Sydney, perhaps you could start us off by highlighting some of the pertinent issues.
Current guidelines have evolved from what is pragmatic rather than what is evidence-based. I think we have to all balance the benefits of detection of recurrence as early as possible with costs, with radiation exposure, with patient anxiety involved with scanning. It is a fine balancing act. So Ed, perhaps you could tell us what some of the advances in radiology are that have been developed to mitigate the potential radiation harm.
CT scan is the modality that often gives our patient the highest amount of radiation exposure. So the things we have done is we have dialed down the KVP, the energy of photons. Also, we can do modulation of the doses around the patient. Better filtering, better detectors, all means that we can administer lower radiation dose to the patient. In terms of the PET, the detectors are also evolving rapidly. They're becoming more and more sensitive. And being digitized PET camera, we can reduce the radiation that we inject into the patients, therefore a lower dose as well. I'll just touch on the pros and cons of some of the imaging modality. CT is a very fast, reliable way of imaging our patients. It can cover a large area from head to the thigh. It's widely available, high spatial resolution. It gives fantastic anatomic detail, such as the lung. It's also very good with liver, spleen, if we give contrast as well. However, the downside is it does give radiation to our patients, and 1% of our population will be allergic to contrast. Up to 1 in 100,000 will have severe allergic reaction as well. PET is now commonly used. It's a molecular imaging modality that allows us to image the patient from head to toe. And it's basically giving the patient radioactive pharmaceutical, and commonly FDG, to provide a metabolic map of the activity in these patients. So it's a molecular or metabolic imaging technique. It doesn't have a lot of anatomic detail. Therefore, it's often combined with low-dose CT or diagnostic CT. The problem is also that radiation exposure to our patients and the high cost to the community and society. MRI is a fantastic imaging modality for the brain and the CNS system because it has such a good soft tissue and contrast resolution. The cost is an issue, and some of our patients can be claustrophobic, and therefore MRI may not be a choice for these patients.
So do you think whole body MRI might be the direction in the future?
Yes, there are PET MRs, these new scanners emerging, and that will mean we don't need to perform the CT in combination with PET, using the MR to provide the anatomic detail. So it would be fantastic to reduce dose, and also for soft tissue characterization, such as liver lesions, such as picking up brain mets. And it's commonly used for pediatric population as well. The other new direction is these ultra-wide coverage PET CT scanner that can scan head to the thigh at the same time. And these detectors are ultra-sensitive as well. We can give very low dose of radiation to the patient, and the scan can be completed as short as 5 minutes.
Excellent. Great things to look forward to. So currently, the commonest scan regimes would be PET CT and brain MRI versus whole body CT. What's the best way of interspersing PET CT, brain MRI, and whole body CT?
I think what's really important when we're thinking about imaging patients is what's the setting that we're doing this in, whether it be early melanoma, advanced melanoma. We're going to touch on this through the podcast. Are we trying to stage the patient at initial diagnosis to see if they have metastases? Do we want to follow people up after treatment to see if they've recurred? Or are we trying to determine response to therapy after we've given them drug therapy, for example? So I think the setting is really important. Broadly speaking, we always want to fully image the patient, including the brain. CT is very much the default standard imaging modality, particularly in clinical trials, as that provides a structural representation of the organs and potential metastases in the organs. PET has additional advantages, particularly when people have in-transit metastases, perhaps small bowel disease, bony metastases. I find PET is particularly useful there. There's a lot of interest in looking at PET because it's a representation of the metabolic activity of the tumor. And PET in response to drug therapy is very interesting as well, which no doubt we'll probably talk about. The role of MRI is somewhat controversial. We know brain metastases are quite common with melanoma. We know the morbidity that brain metastases can have if not detected early. But on the other hand, MRI is expensive. It is not available everywhere all the time around the world whenever you want it. And there can be some concerns over serial MRI scans with the gadolinium in terms of gadolinium deposition, which isn't excreted by the body. So I think my rule is, in terms of the brain, we always want to image the brain with either a CT or an MRI. How often we do those, I think, really depends on the setting, which we'll get to through the podcast.
Let's go back to the early melanoma. Kevin, what surveillance is recommended in early stage melanoma, the stage 1A, 1B, and 2A?
In these early stage patients, presumably they may have undergone a sentinel node biopsy to confirm that they are, in fact, early stage without nodal involvement. The role of imaging really falls down to clinical examination and along clinical follow-up lines. If there's any clinical suspicion of an emerging nodal met or met anywhere else, that can guide the targeted imaging profile depending on what is found clinically. But it's important to know that sentinel node biopsy is a very technical procedure. It involves multiple specialties involving nuclear medicine physicians, radiologists, surgeons, and at the end of the line, the histopathologists examining the sentinel nodes that are procured. Although it's very accurate in the right hands, previous studies have shown that there may be a very low false negative rate, and that the false negative rate could be considered around the 3% mark. And by that I mean patients that are sentinel node negative that go on to develop regional nodal metastases are considered to be false negatives on the sentinel node procedure. And that can happen because of inaccurate mapping or the surgeon being unable to procure the sentinel nodes, or indeed the histopathologist not identifying a metastasis that may in fact be present. So whenever there's these technical issues, either during the mapping process or during surgery, that for that patient means that it's not confident that the sentinel nodes have been procured. And by that I mean there could be very complex lymphatic drainage leading to multiple nodal fields, and it may in fact be impossible to procure all of the sentinel nodes, particularly for the more complex patients, typically with head and neck melanomas. So if there's a concern that the sentinel node biopsy procedure has been compromised, then these are patients that would certainly benefit from targeted imaging surveillance of the nodal fields still considered to be at risk.
So for T1A melanomas, how early or how thin is too thin for routine surveillance?
How thin is too thin?
For routine surveillance. So if a patient were to turn up with a 0.3 versus a 0.5 versus a 0.7 without any other adverse features, what would your recommendation be?
Right. And have they had a sentinel node biopsy procedure? Or?
No. So most of these patients would not routinely have sentinel node biopsy.
Right. I don't know if there's a lot of studies that can guide us in that. And we have to be doctors. We have to examine the patient, assess their clinical status as well as their psychological status. You know, the diagnosis of melanoma can be incredibly traumatic and anxiety provoking. So the fact that an imaging procedure is done has to be weighed up against the possible psychological impact that has, both positive and negative, for clearing the patient for having metastases, or in fact discussing the possibility of false positive findings as well.
Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to dial in because I agree with what Kevin has said. And I think what is important is that if there's no indication in the guidelines to consider a sentinel lymph node biopsy, then that means there's also, to my opinion, no indication to do regular imaging in those patients. Obviously, with the thin melanomas, that is a bit controversial of when to offer those a sentinel lymph node biopsy. But the rate on average for all melanoma patients with a breast thickness up to 0.8 millimeters is 5%. So that means the overwhelming majority of these cases will do well, will not have any sentinel lymph node metastases nor other metastases during the follow-up period.
But I suppose it is still very important, as Kevin was saying, that it doesn't supersede clinical examination. This is like clinical palpation of a regional nodal basin.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the follow-up of the patient with clinical examination and targeted imaging still is definitely what you should be doing in these cases.
Moving on to the higher risk patients, so high risk stage 2 and stage 3 melanomas, what scanning regime would you normally follow, Alex?
For these patients, to start off with the stage 3 patients to begin with, I think my practice is that once we've had the diagnosis of a stage 3 melanoma, that means there is spread to the lymph nodes in those cases, or they have intrasen metastases. This, per definition, means that these patients are high risk. And the high risk means that they are eligible for adjuvant systemic therapy as well, and potentially for adjuvant systemic therapy trials. Therefore, I would consider these patients to have imaging at baseline to see if there isn't any other metastases in the nodal fields or distantly, to have a proper staging to be sure that we're dealing indeed with a stage 3A, 3B, etc., before referring them on to the medical oncologist for discussion of further treatment options.
So what follow-up scans would you normally order if a patient is found to be sentinel node positive?
Yeah, that's a good one, because I don't think we've had high-level clinical trials looking at different regimens. So what we use is basically what we've had from the clinical trials. And the clinical trials in the era before we had any effective systemic therapies was the MCLT trial, where patients were followed up with nodal ultrasound. So that used to be the common modality to follow up node-positive patients. After that, we got the adjuvant therapy trials, where they mandated 3-monthly CT scans in most of those trials for years on end. So practice has evolved pragmatically with those adjuvant therapy trials going into clinical practice now and no longer being in the trial population, that we simply adopted that same schedule they use in those clinical trials to follow up those patients at 3 to 4 monthly intervals, usually with CT scans. The question is, how long do you go on with 3 to 4 monthly scans? Do you stop at 2 years and switch to 6 monthly scans, or do you go on for 3 years and then switch? How long do you go on in general? Do you stop at 5 years, or do you continue on to 10 years out? I don't think we've had any good high-level evidence looking at that. So I tend to be pragmatic and around 3 to 4 months for the first 2 to 3 years, and then switch to 6 monthly to year 5. And then from year 5 to year 10, do a scan once a year. But maybe Alex has another comment, because he also has seen these patients nowadays.
A lot of people with high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 melanoma are receiving systemic therapy now. So in a way, the medical oncologists are doing the bulk of the follow-up, including ordering imaging on these patients. Of course, they're still having skin surveillance, whether that's with their surgeon or dermatologist. I think what's critical when we talk about any investigations, including imaging with patients, is what is the
likelihood of finding an event. So when we're looking at imaging patients looking for recurrence, what is the likelihood of that recurrence at that point in time based on the patient's initial diagnosis, the treatment they've received, and how far they are down the line? Definitely, I think that there's little doubt that it's worth adequately staging high-risk patients at diagnosis, whether that is preoperatively or postoperatively, depends on how much information you've got at that time. But definitely moving forward with systemic therapy, we are imaging people at regular intervals. I agree with Alex that at present, we largely follow the clinical trial protocols, which weren't necessarily defined by evidence. We know that the highest risk periods of recurrence are in the first year, particularly the first 3 to 6 months, and it makes sense to be imaging more frequently there. But we know for different stages of melanoma, for example, 3A melanoma, the risk per 3 to 6 month period really reduces really quickly, and we can probably spread that out further. In essence, we need a lot more research to look at how people are recurring, when they're recurring, and what modalities are best to detect that recurrence.
Alex, you stated that you would actually scan patients preoperatively down. That's a controversial point because based on our own research, it has been shown that prior to, if one is planning a sentinel biopsy, there is actually no reason to perform baseline scanning prior to the sentinel biopsy because false positives are actually much more likely to delay the treatment and surgery for one's melanoma.
Look, absolutely. And again, as a medical oncologist, I've not often met these people at this point, but I think quite frequently people that present perhaps with large ulcerated primary melanomas that, you know, when we say clinically on examination have normal lymph nodes, I certainly observe there is a tendency for clinicians perhaps to think about imaging patients because one option, if people clearly don't have metastatic disease, we may pick up clinically apparent nodal disease that opens up opportunities for neoadjuvant therapy. But I think Alex is keen to chip in.
Yeah, definitely, because we've also noticed that trend and people having a sort of a Pavlov reaction where they have these thick ulcerated melanomas and are like, oh, send the patient off for a PET scan. And the question is, and maybe Kevin will be able to comment after me on this, if that's the correct modality to scan these. So what we did back when I was in Amsterdam, we did a pilot study where we offered T4 melanoma patients a PET CT scan and an ultrasound of the draining lymph nodes prior to their central lymph node biopsy to see what picked up the metastases. And actually, both tests were in that small pilot study, albeit, were equal in detecting the upfront metastases. However, also, still after that, the patients that didn't have any metastases on the imaging went on to have their central lymph node biopsy. And again, still a high rate of those turned out to be positive. So doing that imaging upfront, and perhaps it best be ultrasound upfront, doesn't preclude you from doing the central lymph node biopsy thereafter because you can still miss smaller metastases on the imaging.
Which I must add is our current practice at Melanoma Institute Australia. Is that they would get lymphoscintigraphy, ultrasound to check on their sentinel nodes prior to biopsy in theatre.
I think a concept that I've been thinking about has been this issue of what has been termed modality creep of imaging. And Alex, you brought up MSLT-1 and MSLT-2, which clearly used well-trained ultrasound facilities to follow patients up. And over the past 5 to 10 years, even since the MSLT2 data was finalized and published, this modality creep, the substitution of expert-performed ultrasound for typically PET CT or a diagnostic CT as it being adequate, has always worried me because clearly these different imaging modalities have different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, to translate the clinical outcomes from those very high-powered studies, when you're changing the protocol because of this modality creep, I think is very fraught with worry in my perspective.
On that note, so Alex, for your patients who are having cross-sectional scanning, so PET CT, a whole body PET in their follow-up, do you think there is still a role for high-resolution ultrasound of the nodal basin where a positive sentinel node had previously been diagnosed?
Yeah, it's a great question because obviously we had the MSLT 1 and 2 trials with the routine ultrasound surveillance, and then we have these active and systemic therapy trials that use cross-sectional imaging, but not routinely used ultrasound surveillance. So at Melanoma Institute Australia, we performed a study of our patients to look at this and to see those patients that had both imaging modalities done, actually, which had the highest rates of picking up. And ultrasound was very sensitive in finding all the nodal metastases, but PET-CT showed to be equal in finding all of those lymph node metastases. At the same time, PET-CT was then able to find also other metastases, other local regional metastases like the satellite or in-transit metastases and distant metastases. So in my view, that means that the patient is best off being followed up with a cross-sectional imaging. And if you're doing that, then you need not do ultrasound at the same time anymore.
Yeah, coming from myself, a sort of sonologist, obviously I've got a wheelbarrow to push, but I think that that research that you did, Alex, was hugely important. You know, all of a sudden we're faced with patients that are getting FDG, PET-CT, whole body scans, MR scans with systemic therapy, and we've got this rich data set of now multimodality imaging. How do we make sense of this all? You know, what's important, what's not? How can we get the most out of imaging studies to minimize the inconvenience to the patient? So I completely agree with you. It's an important data set to look at. However, you would acknowledge, though, that there is a subset of patients that are destined to only recur in the sentinel node biopsy field, albeit something like 5%.
And I was going to say, Kevin, just on that, I think we all are pretty confident that, in theory at least, ultrasound should be better than PET at detecting small, early recurrences in the axillary basin. As a medical oncologist, we obviously treat people that are at risk of local and distant recurrence. When we give drug therapy, part of what we're doing when we're imaging patients is looking for toxicity, such as early stage pneumonitis, for example. There's research into looking at pancreatic volumes that potentially putting at risk of people of immunotherapy, diabetes, etc. But I guess the theoretical risk I think about when I don't routinely recommend people have ultrasound monitoring is if there was a small early nodal recurrence in those patients that wasn't clinically palpable and wasn't evident on PET, could they be at risk in a short period before the next PET or CT scan for their lymph node to blow out of control and miss the opportunity for resection? So is a delay of diagnosis of a few months between ultrasound and cross-sectional imaging clinically a concern for us?
That's a great statement to segue into my next question. So routine scanning rests on the premise that early detection of asymptomatic recurrence is beneficial. So Alex, is there strong evidence that medical therapy is more effective when the burden of disease is less?
Fantastic. So I'm going to contradict myself again. But look, in truth, we do not have prospective direct evidence, clinical or translational, that definitively starting systemic therapy earlier with lower burden disease has a biological effect and treatment definitively works better with earlier stage disease. We extrapolate from trials in patients that have lower disease at baseline and their outcomes versus people with higher disease. Biologically, they may be very different in terms of the kinetics and the biology of their melanoma. The short answer is we don't know. I think my preference, though, in terms of trying to detect recurrence early or progression early for metastatic patients is to try and avert a clinically significant event, such as a bleeding brain metastasis. If we could pick it up early at 3 or 4 millimeters in size versus when in the old days we'd hear about people recurring in the emergency department where they'd have a hemorrhagic bleed from a brain metastasis or an interception from a bowel metastasis, etc. So I think detecting early disease at a lower volume can mean that you can have people fitter, weller to start treatment in a better position. But I don't think we have convincing data yet that actually starting treatment earlier actually has an overall survival impact.
But Alex, I would say that what you're talking about is a threshold. Clearly, treating someone with early melanoma is much more advantageous than stage 4 melanoma. But there's a threshold somewhere where the burden of disease crosses, where starting treatment at that point is detrimental to the patient. And we don't know where that line is. I would advocate then, in the absence of evidence, we should be using imaging that we think is the most accurate and the most sensitive in picking up early disease. And brain metastases, yep, MR would be that, I presume. But clearly for nodal metastases, I think there's reasonable evidence that ultrasound is pretty sensitive, and maybe due to its no radiation burden, its relatively widespread availability, and the fact you can do diagnostic procedures at the same time as doing the imaging. I mean, that's not a bad strategy to follow up.
Yeah, look, I agree. But I think that as we've talked about, and this we'll go round again, yep. It's segueing in the different modalities. You know, ultrasound is great, but, you know, we can't presume that all people go from primary to nodal to distant metastatic disease. And we do want to think about the systemic potential disease burden or the risk of systemic recurrence. So I think it's a case of how do we dovetail these modalities in an efficient manner, in a cost-effective, health economic manner for patients that actually improves their outcomes.
I think it is fair to say that when the risk of systemic metastasis is high, then I suppose the cost-benefit ratio probably sway towards more cross-sectional scanning versus regional nodal basin ultrasound. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I actually wanted to answer the question about losing the control of the nodal basin if you pick it up slightly later on cross-sectional imaging. So again, from the study that we did at MIA, we didn't find, although the nodes were larger after resection on cross-sectional imaging than compared to those that were found on ultrasound, that it didn't lead to different outcomes clinically of those patients, albeit that's a small series, of course. I don't know, maybe anecdotally, patients that progress so rapidly that you lose the option to perform surgery. So usually if they're following any surveillance protocol, be it with the cross-sectional imaging, be it with ultrasound, you'll be in time to still salvage those patients by surgery.
And I just might mention, I think there's a clinical trial that's in follow-up now that I think is going to answer this issue quite definitively. So just to not labor the point, but in an era where sentinel node biopsies were performed and we were no longer doing completion lymph node dissections, ultrasound monitoring was recommended. That's what the trial showed. The early adjuvant trials of drug therapy, where they were having CTs, all mandated a completion lymph node dissection. Very recently, there's been an adjuvant clinical trial, the BMS-098 clinical trial, that does not mandate completion lymphadenectomy. Those patients on trial have to have ultrasound on top of their cross-sectional imaging. And I think we're going to have prospective data, like Alex has mentioned, that can truly demonstrate the additional benefit of ultrasound in that sentinel node positive population.
Excellent. Now, Alex, how do we incorporate response to medical therapy into the frequency of scanning for stage 3 and stage 4 disease? So, in the neoadjuvant setting, I mean.
Yeah. So look, I think what we love about neoadjuvant, so preoperative drug therapy, as well as treating people with advanced disease, is we give drug when disease is on board and we can see the impact of that drug effect, either radiologically or pathologically. Unlike in the adjuvant setting where we give treatment essentially in the dark, we have no idea if people are responding or not. And we very much have to sort of plug people into a schedule of follow-up that everyone has to follow. In the neoadjuvant and the metastatic setting, we can tailor that very much accordingly to the patient and their response to treatment. So, for example, in the neoadjuvant setting, people will have some imaging. They'll have 6 weeks' worth of therapy, often have some additional imaging prior to surgery. If they're responding on that imaging, we get a lot of confidence that they're actually a true responder to treatment. Currently, they still have surgery. One day, we may be diminishing the degree of surgery we do. Potentially, one day, we may even omit surgery in some extreme cases. But we then also get the path response. People that have a complete pathological response have a very low risk of recurrence, and we are generating the data now that suggests that they may not need any or certainly very infrequent imaging follow-up thereafter, as opposed to people that don't respond, higher risk, need more intensive follow-up. Similarly, in the metastatic setting, if we have patients with stage 4 melanoma that have an early complete response to therapy radiologically, or more commonly, a deep partial response but a complete metabolic response on PET, these people do very well over the long term with a very low risk of recurrence, and we can stretch out and reduce our imaging frequency accordingly. So tailoring that the imaging frequency and modalities based on the patient's current clinical condition and response to treatment is exactly what we need to do. And I think that's what we all do at the moment.
Alex, just to add to that, I think you mentioned those that have a response to neoadjuvant on a radiology are usually also shown to have a very good response on histopathology. But those that do not respond on radiology can still have an excellent response on histopathology. So I think pathology in those neoadjuvant cases is still the gold standard.
Yeah, absolutely. If the scans look good, we're very confident people are going to do well. But if it looks like things haven't changed, more often than not, people have still had an influx of immune cells into the tumor. So the volume or the bulk looks the same. But clearly, things have done better. And I think that's where things like PET, maybe even high-resolution ultrasound could tell us more about the dynamics of what's going on in those scenarios.
Let's look at the case study, shall we? Now, a 60-year-old patient with a 3 millimeter breast lobe thickness, ulcerated tumor mitotic rate 5, melanoma on the forearm with a positive sentinel node single in the axilla. How would you manage this patient's?
Yeah, so a 3 millimeter ulcerated melanoma is a T3B on the TNM and HCC staging system. And with a positive single sentinel node as N1A, that translates to a stage 3C in the HCC staging system. We know that the survival of those patients, despite having had the best surgeons perhaps in the world looking after them, is poor if you don't do anything else. So more than half of those will recur within 5 years after the surgery. And actually, also a large proportion of those patients will already show to have more than that single sentinel lymph node positive. So the adjuvant trials have always mandated a screening phase in the 12 weeks after surgery of these patients prior to getting onto those adjuvant trials. And it was shown that about 15% of patients actually had more lesions on their baseline scanning, which precluded them from going on to those trials. Extrapolating that data into clinical practice means that I would perform a baseline scan to be sure that there isn't further disease either in the nodal basin or further on distant metastases before continuing on considering the appropriate management of this case.
Let's say at 4 weeks postoperatively, the PET CT showed another FDG AVID lymph node within the axilla, let's say SUV 6.0. What is the role of a high-resolution ultrasound in this stage? And what is the role of a biopsy? Should we be delaying and do another PET CT?
I'll start with the PET CT. So at 4 weeks post-surgery, I think there will be a lot of post-operative inflammation, and that is a key factor that can cause false positive. So in this situation, we have to use a lot of caution when we interpret the PET CT. We know in this cohort, we will see high rate of false positives. In some of the retrospective studies I've come across, every true positive we picked up in this cohort, we will have another two false positive. So maybe about 30% of the scans will be positive, but only 10% or less will be true positive disease. So it will really have to use a lot of caution in interpreting the finding in this scenario. We will need to know where the surgery was done, where was the primary lesion, and which nodal basin has been operated. And we perhaps put more emphasis on distant disease that we can pick up. And in this cohort, we also tend to pick up additional primary tumor, such as breast cancer, prostate cancer, thyroid cancer. About 3%, 3 to 5% of those cases, also something to be considered. So of course, we don't want to cause delay in patients' management, but these are the findings that we need to be aware of.
Is there a role, Kevin, for a high-resolution ultrasound in this case where you have a FDG avid lymph node within the dissected nodal basin at 4 weeks post-operative?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a hot node on PET, it can look markedly different on ultrasound depending on the etiology. You know, a metastatic melanoma node with an SUV of 6. In my mind, I'm imagining the ultrasound very different to a reactive inflamed lymph node due to postoperative surgery. I say that confidently, but there's a lot in the middle. So the role of the high-resolution ultrasound is to make a call on whether it is very confidently reactive. And if it's not, you'd biopsy it and take it further, because I think that would be important for the patient's situation.
So we call it false positive because we see inflammation, but you can't be certain that there isn't a metastasis. And that's why we call on Kevin to help us out with the focused ultrasound, I'd consider that actually not really to be false positive in my mind. I'd consider that appropriate management to segue the patient in the correct direction of Alex Menzies for the appropriate management of either adjuvant or maybe a neoadjuvant case if there's another node still present in that patient.
Yep. Look, Alex, I agree with you. And there's a dogma that the photons never lie. So I would argue there's no such thing as false positives and you commit only false interpretations. So thanks for that comment.
That's right.
So Alex, let's say the patient went on to have post-operative adjuvant immunotherapy, whether with or without a completion nodal dissection, depending on the biopsy result of Kevin's. What then would be your follow-up scan regime?
So look, for high-risk stage 3 patients on adjuvant therapy, even with adjuvant treatment, sadly there are recurrences and they are fairly frequent and particularly in the first year. So I would be thinking in this scenario of 3 monthly CT scans. I'd probably image the brain with a dedicated MRI every 6 months, so every alternative scan, and potentially think of a PET scan once a year. Again, we don't have a whole lot of data to demonstrate the benefit of that, the pros and cons as we've outlined before, but every 3 months in the first year, particularly for this 3C patient, regardless of whether they're having systemic therapy or not, with somewhat increasing separation of those scans beyond particularly the 2-year mark.
Currently, many of our surgeons at MIA would perform for a T1B and T2A melanomas in patients who have not undergone a sentinel node biopsy routine ultrasound scanning of their sentinel nodal basin. And for patients in stage 2B, 2C, and 3A, assuming that the sentinel node tumor deposit is less than 1 millimeter, they would have, in the first 3 years, 6 monthly PET CT and brain MRI. And from year 4 to year 10, yearly PET CT and brain MRI. As for the stage 3B, 3C, and 3D, and stage 4 melanomas, they will go on to 3 monthly PET CT, brain MRI for the first 3 years, followed by 6 monthly for year 4 and year 5, and yearly from year 5 onwards to year 10. Obviously, all this data is going to be tempered by neoadjuvant studies. It's going to be nuanced, hopefully, with the patient's response to neoadjuvant therapy based on their pathology response. Do we think that there is any need to actually change that in the near future?
Look, I think we do. So first of all, biomarkers that predict outcome, risk, response to treatment are urgently needed. We need to better sift out the patients that are low risk versus high risk, and neoadjuvant therapy helps us do that a bit. So definitely we need to tailor this further. I do wonder if with the regimens you described before, we are scanning people too often. I certainly don't do PET scans routinely at every scan for every patient. I would very rarely, if ever, do that. There would be clinical scenarios that would mandate PET as my preferred modality.
Over a whole body CT. So you would do a whole body CT instead of a PET.
Yes.
In that situation, is the whole body CT of radiation level as compared to a PET CT?
If you do diagnostic CT, BN cap, brain, neck, chest, abdomen, pelvis, that's probably about 20, 25 millisievert. If you do FDG PET plus a low-dose non-contrast CT, it's about 12 to 15 millisievert. So it's a bit lower, except then you don't have the benefit of the IV contrast to look at the liver and the abdominal structures. So if you combine everything together, you do the PET plus diagnostic CT, then you're looking at about 30.
No, I think if you would actually do a PET and a diagnostic CT. But if you're, Alex, if your issue is over-scanning, then I would argue that the PET CT.
So I think the frequent, I think we potentially scan people too frequently. So I think we could perhaps scan people less often. I think we've made it very clear, no scan is perfect. PET has advantages, CT has advantages, MRI, none of them are perfect. But I think if we actually look at the data, we're generating this and soon to be publishing this at MIA, particularly for the adjuvant therapy patients, their dynamic risk over time changes. And yet currently we basically scan them at the same time points no matter what. It's illogical. So I think we need to be vested in evidence. Imaging costs money. It does cause anxiety for patients. There may be a mild, very small degree of radiation risk, but I think we need to utilize our resources most efficiently, and we need to focus our resources in those at greatest risk and therefore at greatest need.
So it's a great thing that we now have our MIA prediction tool of recurrence, and hopefully not too long, the prediction tool of recurrence on immunotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, and Alex, your interpretation and discussion on how to logically apply imaging for follow-up of patients is very nuanced, and that's perfect. But I'm constantly surprised at how the patient's experience with imaging plays out. Sometimes it's hugely anxiety-provoking. Other times it's hugely reassuring. So again, it's not just a melanoma at the front of this patient, and they respond very differently to different imaging follow-up protocols. We have to take the patient into account as well.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I think that's a great statement to end on. I think having a routine scan regime is a fine balancing act of balancing costs, balancing radiation exposure and psychological distress with the benefits of early detection of recurrence. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Sydney, Kevin, Ed, Alex and Alex for that engaging discussion. You have been listening to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia and made possible by unrestricted educational grants from Merck Sharp & Dohme Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb and Heine. Just a note to save the date for the Australasian Melanoma Conference, which is being hosted in Sydney on the 25th and 26th of October 2024. We hope you can join us, and please be sure to check out melanoma2024.com. I'd also like to acknowledge that this recording was done on Cammeraygal land, and that this podcast was accurate at the time of recording, which was September 2023. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend or colleague and be sure to leave us a review. For more practice-changing education, sign up to our Melanoma Education portal at melanomaeducation.org.au. Thanks for listening.